This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to our November 2020 program in the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology's Exploring Ethics series. I am Mike Kalichman, Director of the Ethics Center and a professor at UC San Diego. These monthly programs are supported in part by the University of California, San Diego, and normally hosted at San Diego's Fleet Science Center. However, because of the ongoing pandemic, our current programs are being convened online. This format is still new, so we ask your help in making the most of this new opportunity. For those of you new to these programs, our Exploring Ethics series is designed to explore new developments in science and technology with members of the community. We try to identify ethical challenges, such as how the research is done and how the technology is applied, and then with the audience, identify possible solutions to those challenges. Because one of the goals of these programs is defined by audience engagement, we ask that you take advantage of three mechanisms to provide feedback. We invited those who registered to submit questions in advance of the program. Also, at any time from the page on which this is streaming, you can use the Q&A form on the right side of the page to submit your questions. We may not get to all, but we will do our best to cover most of the key issues raised. So, as sort of a framing of this evening's program, New York University journalism professor Mitchell Stevens wrote a few years ago, "I have never found a time when there wasn't a forum for the exchange of news that included sensationalism, that there was always a forum for sensationalism in the way news was conveyed." And yet, we are continually worried about the trustworthiness of what we read. Making our stories sound better than reality has probably always been part of how we communicate with one another. But now, given the importance of getting past the hype in a world of charges of fake news, it is worth asking whether technology can help us sift through news stories to distinguish between bias and objectivity. This is the goal of a company co-founded by Tamara Zubati, a former UC San Diego student in cognitive science, who is now working on her PhD at Georgia Institute of Technology. So for this evening's program, please join me in welcoming Tamara.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Michael, for that warm introduction, and thank you for having me today. I'm Tamara Zubati. I'm the CEO and a co-founder of Veracrypt. We're a technology company, and we use AI to score bias in news. So obviously, this is a really hot topic right now. And today, I'm just going to start by introducing our information ecosystem and kind of explaining why right now we're living in a sort of a new time in that we're living in a weaponized information ecosystem. And so, as Michael kind of pointed out, we've always had kind of sensationalism in our media and in our news. Even before we had the internet, we had radio and we could communicate kind of in different ways. And we would always kind of exaggerate just a bit to make our point more proven. But now we're kind of living in the next iteration of that. And so what is an information ecosystem? The information ecosystem is composed of kind of all of the different information sources and the information channels that exist in our world today. So that's everything from news providers and like local news channels on the TV, radio, Twitter, all kinds of social media, any information on the internet, Reddit. All of that is a part of our information ecosystem. And there's kind of different actors. So news providers are kind of the classic who you think of providing news. And so what they do is they take information and then they report it and then they put it out there. But nowadays, there's kind of different regulations where in the past kind of there was laws in America about how if you owned a radio station, you couldn't simultaneously own a newspaper. Those kinds of rules don't exist anymore. And you can own as many information channels as you want and kind of dominate what goes into those. And so in addition, kind of unfortunately right now, the main business model for the news providers is advertising and ad tech marketing. And so as a result, it kind of the arsenal of tools that they use kind of shifted. So one of the tools that's used is botnets, where you can basically really efficiently distribute information through the information ecosystem. And so what this does is it kind of games the existing incentives that are built into our social media and other information ecosystems, and it allows information to spread much more quickly and to a way broader audience than it would have if you had just published it as a news provider into one place. And then finally, kind of, there's certain actors that take advantage of this information ecosystem. And one of the famous ones that made the news was, of course, Cambridge Analytica. And what they did last year and many times, or last election, many times before our last election and other elections all around the world, was they were able to use targeted content marketing to actually persuade people that they determined to be persuadable to change their perspective in the direction of whoever was paying for the content that they were seeing. So whether that means finding people that might be persuaded to vote in a certain direction and then pumping their news feeds full of that content that is in that direction to persuade them over time to change their decision. So this is actively manipulating their decision by sort of manipulating their information ecosystem. So as you can see, this is kind of a very complicated web, and there's a lot of different actors and they're connected in different ways. So let's kind of dive into that a little bit further. So on this graph kind of shows the flow of information where on the left, you see this arrow and it says information's flowing from the sources through the news providers through social media. And so at the level of sources, let's just go through like a legitimate news process. So the level of sources, there's legitimate sources. There's people who have either experienced things firsthand or were eyewitnesses of some event. And they have stories to tell, and they tell those stories to the journalists, and the journalists document their experience, and they can kind of propagate that on forward into the news. And then other sources might include like public records, say different charities report how much money they spend, or different companies have public filings that they're required to file. And so all of that is kind of primary data that can then be used by journalists and editors to craft into news stories. Once the news story gets published, that's kind of like another form of public record. Now we have this other kind of, we assume that it's kind of slightly validated, right? The news source went through some trouble to kind of discern whether or not this information is legitimate, whether or not that source can be trusted. And different news providers have kind of different methods here. Some news providers will wait to see like many different people confirm. Others have more rigorous processes or less rigorous processes, but it's really kind of up to the journalist. And then once it gets into social media, so say the media company, the news provider actually like posts their news story on Twitter, then it kind of enters the broader information ecosystem where people can actually engage with that content. And so by engage, I mean they can comment on it, they can share it, they can kind of repost it, edit it, make their remarks about it, and in that way kind of perpetuate that into the discourse of our global community on social media. And so, unfortunately, this system kind of lends itself towards being grounds for some kind of unfriendly interference at different places. And the biggest challenge here is that it's really difficult to hold any one party accountable because misinformation at any level can have really strong downstream effects. So as an example, say that the content or the person that is the source is actually a clandestine actor with an ulterior motive that might not just be to inform the world, but maybe it's to push a particular story or to do something else. And maybe they're in possession of illegally obtained information. Maybe it was hacked. Maybe they hacked somebody and they have their private and personal information and they wish to disseminate it in a way that's not, like on Twitter, it's illegal to share hacked information. And so at that point, it kind of becomes the choice and the responsibility of the journalist or the editor to pick, to decide, is this information that we trust? Does this information go into the model of how we think that we view trustworthy sources and trustworthy information? And then they have to go through that process. But again, it's really subjective. There's no way to know. For all the news provider knows, the information that they're sharing is legitimate, but then it might not be. They might not know. And so, unfortunately, they're kind of like the gatekeeper. And so once information makes it through them, through the gate, then it gets out onto social media. And what we see is social media uniquely incentivizes the spread of really divisive content. Why? This is just because the way that the algorithms are designed, the algorithms that show you your newsfeed, for example, they're designed to promote posts that have more engagement. So more likes, more shares, more retweets. But there was a study that found that, unfortunately, fake news, fake tweets travel much faster than real tweets on Twitter, for example. And it's just kind of some basic facts of human psychology about the types of content that we choose to engage with. Either the content really, really strikes a chord in us, we're really against it, if it's something that we disagree with, and that might urge us to react and to comment on it or retweet it or something. Or maybe we agree with it a lot and we just think everybody in the world should hear about this amazing article and we want to spread that content. And so in either way, kind of the more sensational the article is, the more it engages you and the more people engage with it. So what this creates is kind of a cycle. It's a positive feedback loop. And it's a positive feedback loop of engagement. So as more and more people engage with the post, it spreads further. And so kind of most recently, we've heard about the Hunter Biden story. And what happened there was it's actually not exactly clear at what level of the information ecosystem there was a problem and who, in fact, has to be held accountable. So let's start at the very top. So at the source, right? The source of this information is dubious. We're not exactly sure. Is this information obtained legitimately? Or is this information obtained through an illegal method that then reveals private and personal information in ways that aren't appropriate? Okay, so let's just give it the benefit of the doubt and assume that perhaps the information might be legitimate. So then if I'm an editor, such as the editor at the New York Post that approved the story and then published it on Twitter, in my mind, I'm doing everything right. I am receiving information from a legitimate source or a source that I perceive to be legitimate and by my organization's standards has met that legitimacy criteria. And I am using this information that I perceive and my organization perceives to be public record, and I am presenting it. And this is where it gets really interesting. Because on Twitter, we have people that basically suppress that story from coming out. Because as we said, on Twitter, it's illegal to post content that is obtained through hacking or illegitimate methods. And so at that point, now we've created a conflict where Twitter says that the information was obtained at the source level in a non-legitimate way, but the news provider doesn't have that same reality, right? In the news provider's mind, source was legitimate, source was shared, information was suppressed. So the downstream effects of this are we are all living in the information ecosystem. And unfortunately, we don't really have a lot of say in that system because the parties who really direct the conversation are the ad providers. This might sound a little bit of a stretch, but in reality, the majority of the profits of news providers come from advertising. And when they propagate the stories really widely, one of the main intentions for the title in grabbing you so that you can click on it is so that you click on it and you see the ads that have been targeted for you. So that also means that maybe the headline that I see is the headline that's been designed to push my buttons and propagated by a botnet. We'll have different ads, and maybe we'll even be a slightly different headline than the headline that somebody else sees who maybe doesn't share my same political beliefs or maybe doesn't have the same personal demographic information that I have that's used by the ad to kind of predict what happens next. And so in this way, the ads kind of actually drive the whole ecosystem. And as a result, we see kind of a clear problem where information isn't driving the ecosystem. It's ads. And then what results is this mass kind of manipulation of the public where it's not actually clear when you're immersed in this information ecosystem and you're seeing these things pop up every single day and you're just thinking, oh, okay, it's just an ad, it's just a picture. But in reality, people are paying for you to see those ads and for you to see those pictures, and they're subtly shaping and manipulating your opinions over time. And so we like to use the analogy of kind of a food. So if you're buying food and you know that you're like allergic to nuts and the food says that there's nuts on it, there's a label that says there's nuts, you're probably going to avoid that. Maybe the situation isn't so subtle. Maybe you don't have an allergic reaction, but maybe you're just trying to avoid really heavily
heavily processed stuff. And so you can read the label and you can see, you know, this is full of this chemical and this is full of this chemical. I'm probably not going to buy that. That doesn't exist. Those kinds of labels don't exist for our information. And so when we take in information, we kind of have no choice but to just let it wash over us and let it affect our brains. And it really takes a lot of discipline and a lot of work to read content, receive it, and then actually open-mindedly process it and allow it to be assimilated into your model of the world. Most of the time, our brain isn't working oh so hard. And unfortunately, the ad tech ecosystem actually takes advantage of this kind of challenges and the inherent kind of brain biology of our brains. And so Dr. Shoshana Zuboff is kind of a very famous thinker in this space. She wrote this book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And in her book, her thesis is basically that we as humans, as we engage with the internet, as we engage with our information ecosystem online, we leave behind little breadcrumbs. And those breadcrumbs, maybe how long we hovered over a photograph or how long we scrolled or what we searched for, what emails we sent, what Google Docs we wrote, all of that information paints a very complete picture of the kind of person that we are, kind of beliefs that we have, kind of choices that we make, the things that we buy, and the things that we're likely to do and buy in the future. And what this does, what ad tech does with this information, is aggregate it into these massive, massive, massive data lakes and warehouses and huge, huge operations, to the point where data is now the number one biggest market in the entire world, surpassing oil in value. It's the most valuable asset. It's worth over $13 trillion. And so Shoshana talks about this and she says, this new reality where our data flows are actually being used to predict our behavior, this is actually surveillance capitalism. It's like the next phase of capitalism. And what she says is surveillance capitalism unilaterally claims human experience as free raw material for translation into behavioral data. And then that behavioral data is what's then used to target us for the ads that we get through our news, through Facebook, and all of the other kind of things in our information ecosystem. And so what she says is to go further, it's no longer enough for these companies to automate information flows about us. The goal is now to automate us. And so it's getting to a point where you don't know if the reason why you have this opinion is because you have this opinion or because you keep seeing ads that tell you to have this opinion. And so this is kind of where Veracrypt comes in. We're like the nutrition label for the news. And our job is to give you enough additional information so that when you're reading the content, you feel empowered to actually integrate that knowledge into your mental representation of the world instead of just reacting to it, instead of just ignoring it. And so essentially, you're empowered to protect yourself and your decisions from manipulation that is and always will be inherent in our information ecosystem. And over the last couple of years, we've gotten pretty good at it. But we also have a really big responsibility. And if you look at our multiple layers of trouble here, there's an opportunity for us to intervene at every level, right? We could help validate the sources. We could help news providers validate what they're going to put out. And then we can, since there's really no gate at all in the social media world, we can help social media users pre-screen their content before they use it. But why would people believe us? And what exactly are we doing? So we're scoring content for bias, but what does that even mean? So brief discussion on what is bias. There's a couple definitions that we use. The first definition is that bias is an inherent dimension of any human decision-making process. And so basically what this means is that as humans, our brains are basically constantly under assault of too much information overload. And evolutionarily, and even in our lifetimes, we've developed rules or heuristics that allow us to act more quickly in our environments and respond to situations more quickly. And maybe we just kind of ignore some of the information. And so these rules, these simplified kind of rules, are our brain's biases. And our brains kind of have a lot of biases. And the next definition is that bias is a prejudice in favor or against something, and usually in a way that's considered unfair. And so these biases are kind of a product of our brains, almost unconsciously, and to a fault. They are kind of resulting from our brains inability to be rational 100% of the time. And so as an anecdote, say that you are have a commute home from work, and this week you decided that you're going to start coming home on this one smaller side street next to your house after you get off the freeway, instead of taking the main road like you normally do. And so this week you notice you've gotten home much faster. You find that you're getting home like 5 minutes faster every single day. And what you think is, wow, I took the street, this smaller street, unlike the bigger street, and I'm getting home faster than I was getting home on the bigger street. But in reality, what really happened was the freeway is really empty right now, because last week when you drove on that street, there was like a lot more traffic. And so this week when you're driving on the new street, it just happens to coincide with the fact that there's less traffic on the freeway. But your brain, because it made that decision to ask you to go to this new street, it's attributing that success to your decision. When in reality, there's no causative relationship between you getting home faster and you choosing this new street to drive on. So causation bias is just one of the brain's kind of standard flaws. Cognitive biases are what they're called. And so other cognitive biases are like anchoring bias, for example, where it's a tendency to base your entire opinion about an issue based on like maybe one small fact or a subset of the bigger set of facts. And so this happens all the time. You see something on social media, you Google it, first article, either direct, you agree with it or you disagree with it, and then bam, that forms your entire perspective on the situation. And so similarly, whenever we're in a, maybe in a bad mood or a good mood, this biases the way that we behave. And also as individuals grow into organizations and we partner up with our buddies and we do new things, we actually encode our own biases into the biases of our organizations. So organizations reflect the biases of the individuals that make up those organizations. And then that's really when biases can gain more power, where then organizations can make decisions that are biased. And then that can have really dangerous downstream effects. So we're an organization and we're tasked with measuring bias in all of our content. So there's kind of quite a bit that we need to do in order to make sure that our methods are up to snuff and actually accepted by the people that are using our scores. So I'll briefly explain kind of our method and what it is that we actually do. So what we do is we take in as much information as we can about the text. We take in the title, we take in the author, metadata, the date, the time, the keywords, synopsis, the actual content itself, and maybe even ads that we can get access to on the page. And then what we do is we run this content through our pipeline of machine learning algorithms, and then they output various scores that we then represent to our end users. And then our end users, which might be reporters or analysts at geospatial risk analysis companies, what they'll do is they'll take those scores and then they'll use them to make decisions. So maybe if you're a news provider, you're deciding whether or not to include a particular source, or if you're in risk analysis, you're deciding how credible a particular story or piece of information might be, and then you might make your decision about what to do with that information. And so obviously, this kind of puts a really big responsibility on us, and we kind of break down our key ethical responsibilities into three parts. And so I'll go through that. The first thing that we have to do is we have to stay really transparent. And transparency for a technology company that whose output is AI, this starts with the data sets. So what data do we feed our algorithms? And so for us, the way that we kind of deal with this problem is we're really transparent about the data sets that we use. We try to use data sets that are either widely published about open source data sets that are publicly available so that other people can recreate or redo our experiments and kind of using the same data. And then we also use these widely published data sets to learn about what it takes to make a good data set and when we're making our own data sets. So one of the data sets that we're making ourselves is kind of a data set about colloquial language versus literary language. And for that, it might be interesting to look at the dictionary or encyclopedia as kind of English speaking in America in the 21st century. And for the last couple centuries, we've relied on dictionaries and encyclopedias as kind of the ways in which we transfer knowledge to the next generation. And we acknowledge that that the way in which we present that information is very objective, and it's really designed to be the clearest, most succinct way to convey the factual information about the world that we live in. But then once what happens next is those algorithms take in the data and then they have to learn rules. So they have to then create their outputs. And in order to create those outputs, they have to learn rules, they have to make decisions. And in a lot of ways, those decisions can become biased, just like our decisions as humans. And so here we have to make sure, can we actually explain why the answer is what it is based on our understanding of what's happening in the algorithm and the data that we gave it? And so this is kind of one of the hardest things to validate. How do you actually make sure that your score represents what you intend it to represent? And this kind of gets back to testing and quality assurance and just repeatedly testing different types of data to see if the outputs are predictable. So for example, we might run a scientific paper through the algorithm, which we know should be very objective. And then if it is scored very objectively, then that's a good sign. Or you can run like a novel, and then maybe you might expect it to be mildly objective. But these are kind of not so rigorous methods. A more rigorous method would be to do a case study. And so our first client, they're an investigative reporting firm in San Diego, and they're called iNewsSource. They have a really rigorous process for how they vet their information and then how they present it. And when we scored all of their content, we scored their entire RSS feed with no additional information. It scored statistically significantly more objective on average than the corpus of news that we had collected from top news providers in the country. So like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post. So it was a lot more objective. And then when we kind of zoomed into that, we realized that Veracrypt was able to segregate all of the content that was written in an editorial way. So every single editorial that they had written, Veracrypt got. And when we explained this to the reporters and the editors, it was really easy for them to understand that, yes, it discriminated against the content that was written in an editorial way, and that's content that was more biased than the content that we made that was more objective. So that makes it more explainable for the end user. And then finally, consistency. It's our responsibility to be consistent in the way in which we apply our algorithm. So if we gave our algorithm to both presidential candidates and for one of them, it was always biased and for the other one, it was always objective, unless that was the reality. And after we had applied it consistently, it would be useless because the whole point is that this is an opportunity to present the perspective of a kind of a neutral third party that doesn't come into it with an emotional perspective on the issue and that doesn't have an opinion. And so then what that allows the people who are receiving the scores to do is to have a more enriched perspective about what's happening that goes beyond just the content that's written on the page. And so, again, our goal is to just empower more efficient human decision making. We're not trying to automate the humans out of the picture. So thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about how Veracrypt deals with ethics concerns in our attempt to kind of empower people in our weaponized information ecosystem. Thank you.
So thank you, Tamara. That was a great introduction to the topic for this evening. And I look forward to talking to you a bit more about that. So I thought what might be an interesting place to start is to think a little more about this question of premise. And I have to admit that I know that a lot of people probably have an event that happened yesterday, which is I hear there was an election that went on, and they may be preoccupied with thinking about that. And one of the features that seems most clear to me, without having to dig into the particular election, is a sense that there's a great deal of division here, and that division is such that both sides view whatever the other side is doing or saying as fake news. And it caused me to think more about what social scientists tell us, which is that people tend not to be convinced by facts and information, but by the attitudes they come with to the table. So yeah. I'm wondering, you know, it sounds like part of the premise of what you're working on is that you want to identify what's sensationalist to avoid the risk that could be used to manipulate someone. On the other hand, maybe the sensationalist part is only going to work for someone who's already predisposed to accept what is sensationalist. So, well, we can come back to the role of advertising in that, but do you have any thoughts on the connection between something being sensational and it's actually working to manipulate someone?
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael, for that question. I think that it kind of comes down to the fact that everybody's biases are different. So something that might stoke the bias of one person or confirm the bias of one person might completely shatter the reality of or perspective of another person. And so I'd like to bring up like cognitive bias as kind of the, or sorry, I meant to say confirmation bias, like a type of cognitive bias that specifically deals with like your perception and your perception of the event. And so the way that confirmation bias works is if you hear something that confirms your belief, then you kind of accept it without giving it a second thought. And so this is where you might see something really sensational. And even though it's alarmingly sensational, because it agrees with your worldview, you might let it slide and say, okay, fine. But on the other hand, if something was as sensational, but it was on the other side of your perspective or the other side of the argument, you might find that you might get really like challenged by that. You might get really emotional about that. And so as a news provider or a person that's outputting the news, you don't really have a way to know what your reader, what position they're going to have. But, and I don't want to get too deep into ad tech yet, but with ad tech, you kind of do. Like you kind of do kind of have a sense of what your reader is feeling and what their perspectives and beliefs are. And then in that way, you can cater your content to more likely guarantee the outcome that you expect, which is basically if you predict that your content's going to agree with their biases, that they're just going to accept it blindly, or if it's going to disagree with their biases, that they're going to get really up in arms and then engage with it.
Yeah. So that's really helpful. And as I said, I do want to come back maybe to advertising later, or maybe somebody else will ask about that, because that's an important part of this space. But I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little more on how this is actually done so people could have a feeling for this. So, I mean, the very first part of that is this is billed as using artificial intelligence. So maybe you should say a bit about what is artificial intelligence?
Yeah, good question. Shout out to Dr. Sadnowski's presentation a couple months ago. That was great. But basically, artificial intelligence is like teaching a machine to learn. And so in our case, what we're teaching the machine to learn is the difference between content that we consider to be objective and content that we consider to be non-objective or biased. And so in terms of kind of how that process works, what it takes is, first of all, a lot of data, a lot of input data. And the input data, there's two different ways that I could go. Either you could have input data that's labeled. So for example, I have the dictionary, right? And I know that the dictionary is true. And I know that the dictionary is objective. But for other types of situations, it might not be so clear. So you might not actually have a labeled data set that says, you know, this story is true or this story is false. And so that type of machine learning or AI is called unsupervised learning. Whereas if you're using a labeled data set, it's called supervised learning. And so if you're using an unlabeled data set and it's unsupervised learning, you can do different types of things and different types of behaviors. So for example, one of the things that we can do with unsupervised learning is we can cluster things without really having any labels about them based on additional information and features that we can gather about them. So for example, our bias score, our sensationalism score, we can then cluster all of the articles that we receive. And then what we find is that they actually naturally separate along the different dimensions that we measure. And so that actually allows us to have insights that we weren't able to see, because the machine can perceive all of the dimensions of the data at the same time when it's a really high multivariate data set, high dimensional. So it's hard for us as humans to really in real time consider all of that.
Right. So, and just to be clear about this pipeline though, so you need to start out with some sort of data set to train your algorithm, if I'm understanding correctly.
For different parts of it, right? So yeah, for the colloquialism, like literary score, for example, definitely, like we need that data set that says, is this true? The dictionary, like we know it's true. But for the other things, like in terms of the clustering, we couldn't give it a data set to learn that. So for our final like editorial bias score, there was no like training data set that we gave it. It was just kind of a sum of all of the features that we had been seeking or measuring.
Okay, good. So I'm going to bounce back and forth with some questions, because several questions have come through. So One of the participants asked, could Facebook use your tool to screen for false information?
We would absolutely love it if Facebook would be so willing to use our tool instead of their computer scientists picking and choosing what information they deem to be true or false. I think that would be great, integrating with any social media.
And there are a couple of questions related to iNewsSource. The first one is, why, if iNewsSource claims that it is an objective, is as objective as any organization can be, did you feel the need to apply VeraCrypt to them? Did they ask you to do that, or did you do this because you felt they were as hard to crack as any other news group? How did that relationship happen?
So that relationship started, I feel like, through a shared mission of kind of making journalism really more objective and trusted in the community, in our culture and society today. And when I first met Lori Hearn, who's the editor-in-chief of iNewsSource, it was like this like collision of passion. And she's doing so much all over the space. And I was so moved by the tools that iNewsSource had already invested in, like Transparify, for example, where they literally link the source document of every fact that they mention in any of their stories directly in, so that the reader can track that, the provenance of that information. And so that was kind of really inspiring for us as an organization. And we were like, yes. And what we found is that there's two camps, right? Either you're doing everything you can, like iNewsSource and their team, to make the most objective content out there. And then for you, what we can do is we can basically verify that. We can say, yeah, you're putting in all of this additional effort, way more above and beyond what everybody else is doing. And in fact, it's paying off. Like, you can see the numbers, the difference in the numbers between the average, like, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, New York Times articles, like 30,000 of those compared to all of your content. And it's just very clear. And then other news providers, maybe for them, they wouldn't really want to publicly display what VeraCrypt scores for them, but maybe they could use that internally to improve internally before they actually put something out there. And so I feel like it's just one of the, I want to like echo what was said in the news story that iNewsSource posted, which is basically they challenged other newsrooms to be brave and to try it, because you never know until you try it. And we really feel like when we start working with a newsroom, it's like a process. We start with kind of an initial diagnostic, if you will. So we'll run all of your content and then we'll show you kind of where you're at. And then from there, it's up to you how you choose to engage with us. If you want to work with us more regularly in your stories to make throughout making your stories like throughout that process, or if you want to do it after the fact because you kind of already feel confident, it's kind of up to you at that point.
Cool. And as I said, there were two Instacart, two messages from iNewsSource. One is from Lori Hearn, who says, Tamara, thank you for mentioning iNewsSource and the results of your audit of our content. And she says, that's an interesting question. Can you talk about the kinds of bias your algorithms discover? What about racial bias, for example?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what we're working on right now is getting into the specific biases that are present. Right now, I feel like what we can do is editorial bias. We can do positive or negative bias, but we can't really get down into saying like this is racially biased or this is gender biased. And there's kind of a couple of reasons. The first reason is it's tough to find labeled data that we can trust the source that labeled it. So if the underlying data that we're using is contested, then it doesn't matter what our output is. So that's kind of the biggest challenge right now, is finding data that all parties can agree on as being valid data. But that being said, that's exactly the area that we're working the hardest in right now, is trying to nail down those specific biases. And what we kind of chose to start with the cognitive biases, which are a little bit easier to deal with than the systemic biases. So for example, like we're tackling causation bias right now, and we're trying to see if there's actually like a computational way that we can measure and model causation bias in the sentence structure. And so once we kind of get a handle on that, I think that we'll be in better shape in terms of addressing other specific biases. But one thing that we always like to point out is the way in which the bias manifests in the language. It's often consistent between different types of biases. So once we're able to locate the bias, any bias, then we have to identify what kind of bias it is. So the kind of that's the step that we're on right now. And we're hoping to present a more broader kind of menu of different options that you can, or different scores that you can obtain in the future once we have that nailed down.
Yeah. So actually, this reminds me that we might want to step back a moment and distinguish between something that's sensationalist and something that's biased, because I can imagine, and I suspect you can too, that you could have something that's sensationalist but not biased, or it's not sensationalist, it's very objective, but it's also very biased. So could you talk a little about those two?
Totally. So positivity and negativity are cognitive biases. If you're in a positive mood, you're more likely or less likely to do certain things. If you're in a negative mood, you're likely to react to situations in a different way. And so how we view it is sensationalism is a type of cognitive bias. And what we think is it has a degree and a directionality. So the directionality is it a positive sentiment or is it a negative sentiment? Is the story hyping something up or is it tearing something down? That's kind of the first dimension of sensationalism. And then it's, well, to what degree, how inflammatory is the language in comparison to other language? And so that's where we kind of get into the adjectives, we get into the more nitpicky kind of details. And so those two parts kind of as a whole make up the sensationalism component. And exactly like what you're saying, a story doesn't have to be sensational to be biased. And in fact, you can have very emotionally detached writing that is conveying a very clear bias. And so that's something that we pick up on, but then those stories would have a high bias rating, but then not a high degree of a sensationalism rating.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So before I ask the next question, so it occurs to me, I mean, if I understand, your training is really, a lot of it is sort of computer science, cognitive science types of things. So are you the social science sort of person in your business, or do you have a team of people working on that? Where does the knowledge about how people interact with one another and so on come from? Is that you or is that others?
Yeah, so two of our three co-founders are very fortunate to have studied cognitive science at UC San Diego, an absolutely amazing program where we were exposed to just that. It was really contextualized human interaction, but put into this lens of, okay, how do we compute this information? How do we model these interactions? And I feel like while Grant, who's our CTO, he kind of took the turn for the technical, I like did all the technical classes, but then I was like more interested in the kind of more complex socio-technological systems. And so that's kind of why I was interested in the PhD. And so at Georgia Tech, I study human-centered computing, which deals with this application of technologies into the socio-technical systems. And it acknowledges that until the technology is in use, you can't really fully understand the technology. And so I definitely feel like I bring that to the team in terms of like that human level, the empathy and that awareness. And I really feel like cognitive science and just design philosophy are really married to entrepreneurship. And in order to be a good entrepreneur, you kind of have to be a master of the design process. And so I feel really like really glad that that's what my training has been in, because I feel really kind of prepared having the theory kind of under my belt. It's different in practice, but it's nice to kind of know that I have that training.
Yeah, no, good. So I wanted to get that on the table, because the next question, for some people that might think, you know, you aren't in a position to answer this, but I suspect you are. So this person asked, how does one overcome the anchor bias when you're faced with new material? What are there things that we can do ourselves to do that?
Yeah, I feel like one of the best things that you can do is put yourself into a mental state that allows you to be more calm and more receptive of information. So if you're in a really stressed out state, your brain's going to be taking even more shortcuts. So what you want to do is you want to prepare yourself to optimally receive the information. So whether that means taking some deep breaths to kind of calm your heart rate, or unfocusing from whatever task you were doing that has you really hyper-focused. All of those factors can help kind of lower your heart rate, lower your stress, and help you be in the most optimal state to receive information. There's like a trade-off in terms of how much stress you have to be under to operate ideally. So it's like a curve. And so if there's not enough stress, you're going to get bored. But if there's too much stress, then you're going to burn out. And so what you want is when you are processing and when you're receiving information, you want to be in just that correct level of alertness. And unfortunately, like our daily schedule and our Western lifestyle doesn't really incentivize us being in that mental state quite a bit. And so for me, like I personally really prioritize that. I value my meditation practice and I value my yoga practice. And I really feel like those practices of mindfulness help me show up in the right way. So that when I interpret information, I'm the most likely to not misinterpret it or to not integrate it correctly. And so as an example, like if I ever go into a meeting, especially like a co-founder meeting, and maybe I'm angry or I have some emotional baggage, then I immediately come into that with a cognitive bias that's going to prevent me from optimally interpreting all of the information that my co-founders are sharing. And at that point, I shouldn't be in that meeting because I'm not even myself. I'm not even showing up in the way that I'm optimally functioning. So yeah, best advice would be to first control yourself and your own mind before trying to engage with the information.
Yeah. So I think it's just great that here you are talking about a technology that is some of the most sophisticated kinds of things we're doing software wise today as a tool. And then saying one of the things we can do personally is meditate.
Yeah.
So thank you. This is from somebody who's a PhD student in machine learning. And they said that to date, the topics of interpretability in modeling and data bias in academia are hotly contested and far from having any consensus. So how can your service be considered fair when we cannot even achieve this in well-behaved lab settings? So there is this, go ahead. So
I think that that's a super fair question. And honestly, I'd love to talk with you offline too. Feel free to reach out to me at tamara@vericrypt.io. But yeah, I think that what it comes down to is us making decisions about the types of things that we do and don't want to score. So for example, right now, like we make no claims to be able to score things like racial bias or gender bias. And in fact, with regards to regular bias, we're slowly pinpointing that what we thought was our general bias score would be better titled our editorial bias score. And so we're kind of constantly refining the way in which we are understanding what exactly we're measuring. And so at this point, we feel pretty confident in our ability to measure editorial bias, like 95% accuracy confident. But that's not the case with other biases. And so those we don't currently have in production, and those aren't available for use. Other things like sensationalism, like that's an easier problem. There's pretty much no debate anymore. There's lots and lots of data sets available to help you measure the sentiment, and then like the degree of the sentiment. All of that's written. It's just a matter of kind of applying it and taking what's available in the open source world and like morphing it into what we need. But I would say that there's like no time like right now to be innovating with these NLP tools, with tools like Allen NLP. Like the knowledge that's available right now and the sophistication that these tools have reached, I feel like the sky's the limit in terms of what we can achieve. And maybe not being in academia kind of gives us certain advantages in terms of the speed at which we can move and the things that we could try and the things that we can kind of fail quickly at to help us along our path in terms of being able to guarantee that the information that we're sharing with people, we can fully stand behind.
Right. And actually, one of my roles as moderator is to ask for more depth on certain kinds of questions. So you mentioned that you're 95% accurate with editorial bias, but there are, of course, risks of false positive and risks of false negative. So when you say 95%, does that mean if I hand you an article that is editorially biased, 95% of the time you would recognize that? Is that correct?
Yes.
But what if I hand you an article that is not editorially biased? What percentage of time would you incorrectly identify that as editorially biased?
Good question. I don't know that off the top of my head. I would have to ask Grant what our false positive rate is.
Yeah. So I just, put on the table for all of us, and I need to do this myself, is that we often hear accuracy numbers, for example, and we should really be asking both what is the false positive rate
Yeah.
And what is the false negative rate? What is, how often am I wrong if it really is there, and how often am I wrong the other way? So
thank you. We'll add that into our materials.
So I think I know the answer to this one, but be interested for you to talk about it. So how can one make sure an algorithm can account for dog whistles? So how can you be sure that, you know, you're not seeing something that is intended to be, to push a bias, but it's obvious, it's hiding somewhere through a dog whistle. So.
Yeah. Basically, it's like two wrongs don't make a right. If you're being biased about being biased, you're still being biased. So,
but can you? But do you think you would detect that, or would that be? I mean, where do you think your detection system would go with something like that?
So, as an example, we like to look at satirical databases because we think that it's interesting in terms of how we would perform. So, like on The Onion, for example, and on Urban Dictionary. We recognize all of that. I would feel kind of, at this point, nobody has had enough access to our system in order to game it yet. But that's something that we're actively concerned with. And so one of the things that we are working on automating right now is basically if we have a user and they send in an article and the article scores like a 3 out of 5. And then they send it in again, and the article scores a 1 out of 5, and we can recognize that it's actually the same content. We flag that internally as like a warning that maybe that person is trying to manipulate the system and make their content more biased rather than less biased. We hope that once it's in production, we'll be able to have that as like a real feature. We're not live yet. We're delivering pilots, but not everybody can start. Any consumer can submit articles, but like for businesses, you have to get in touch with us for us to give you our pilot. So that would really enable somebody to run a lot of different content and really be able to figure out the nuance if they really wanted to. I don't know if that it would be possible. We're still trying to use generative networks to figure out if it's possible to be gamed. But that being said, we are really aware of that. And that's something that we're going to continue being vigilant about in the future.
Yeah, actually, that is a related to a question I was going to ask, which we might want to talk about now. So I envision potentially some sort of a prey-predator relationship here, where as your algorithms hone in on what makes something appear to be sensationalist or biased or otherwise, that users of your system might figure out what that is and then find ways to get around that. So
Does that just
mean that you always have to keep training your algorithms over time to try and see the latest ways people are doing this?
Yeah, I think that's like a really astute observation. Bias changes over time, and our definition of what is sensational evolves over time. And so I definitely feel like if we can contribute to changing the global discourse and the way in which bias is presented in media around the world, that's great. If people are then forced to change their writing style to try to be less biased, I think that's awesome. I really truly believe that if they're trying to mask their bias, we'll still be able to see that. Like, you can't, it would be impossible unless you were stating it objectively for you to not state it not objectively. So yeah.
Well, I will accept that that's plausible, but I guess I do feel that at the end of the day, you can have this black box algorithm looking at data and spitting out an answer. But at the end of the day, a human being has to look at that and say, well, is this making sense? Is this, why would it flag this one as being very objective and not that one?
I feel like one other kind of variable that kind of gets lost is if the article is written by a human, 10 to 1, like the content on the internet is no longer written by humans, it's mostly bot propagated content. It might not even be a higher proportion at this point. And so I feel like when we interact with content, we kind of just assume that it was made by a human. And that I feel like is a dangerous assumption and is one of the things that we're kind of working to flag. Because I feel like that really changes, if you're aware that it's bot content, that changes the way that you approach the story. And so, like, to bring up an example of something that I'm sure we've all kind of gotten over, like advertorials, where, like, on the main news page, you might see a story that isn't actually a story. It's really an advertisement, but it looks exactly like a news story. I feel like we as a culture hopefully have, like, recognize that those things exist, and we don't believe that that's news anymore. But it's kind of that same phenomenon where it looks like news, it smells like news, it's on the same page as the news. Is it the news? And so I feel like there's so many different things that can affect the person's perception of it. There's that the bias is like almost secondary. It comes in after they've already had their initial kind of first subconscious take of the material.
Yeah, so no, it's tricky. Okay, so the next question is, can you delve a bit more into detail on how you are ensuring that your system is defensibly explainable? And I'm not entirely sure I know what they're looking for. I think I do, but if that makes sense to you, why don't you take a stab at that?
Yeah, I'll give it my best shot. I mean, I feel like this is our biggest challenge as an organization, is how do we make sure that our end users can make meaning out of what we're doing? And I feel like one of the best ways is by co-creating with our users and by working directly with the people that are receiving the outputs. And so, for example, with our newest pilot with our geospatial risk analysis firm, we have access to their analysts, and we also have access to their end users. So we know how the analysts at the company are going to receive our scores, and then what they're going to do, how their experience is going to be, and then how they're going to pass that on. So I feel like it's a matter of like learning, because at this moment, there's very like relatively few people in the world, maybe like 1,000 people in the world, that have scored content with Veracrypt. And so there's a lot of explaining that we have to do in terms of helping the broader audience understand what's actually happening. And so I think that process is going to continue to evolve as we continue working with people. So, for example, even the metaphor that we use to describe what we're doing has been changing over time. And so I really like this nutrition label metaphor, because I feel like it really helps more people understand what's happening. But for a long time, we couldn't even really fully express what exactly we were doing, like this weird meta layer on top of the analysis. And also, I feel like one of the things that we've done recently as a business is we've pivoted kind of away from consumers and towards businesses, and specifically towards businesses that take in news as data, because typically those businesses understand our problem really well. They also understand like algorithms really well. And so for them, it's a lot more natural. And they already have maybe algorithms that capture other features that are similar, like maybe they have a clickbait algorithm. And so what their questions are completely different. Their questions are like, okay, well, how close is your editorial bias measure to our clickbait measure? Like, they're already light years ahead of where the public is in terms of understanding this content and having these additional scores. And so I definitely feel like we'll be seeing more and more of these nutrition labels on the information that we're consuming.
Great. Well, Tamara, thank you very much for a really interesting presentation and answering so many questions. So thank you, everybody, for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you at future programs. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.